From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. It's been described as a proof of concept. Researchers at the J. Craig Venter Institute announced the creation of the first man-made cell. Joining me in the studio to talk about some of the possible applications and risks of synthetic biology, Craig Venter, president of the J. Craig Venter Institute, David Rejeski from the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Scholars, Sohi Rastegar of the National Science Foundation. Welcome to you all. Nice to have you here.
Good morning.
Morning.
Join us, as always, with your comments and your questions. 1-800-433-8850 is our phone number. You can also send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Craig Venter, this has been hailed as an exceptional breakthrough. Try to explain what it is that you've accomplished, that you haven't accomplished before. What's new here? What's special here?
Well, we've started a process starting back in 1995 when we decoded the first two genomes in history and started asking questions about what minimal life might be. So my colleagues, Hamilton Smith and Clyde Hutchison and myself, decided we would start to minimize the genome of a small mycoplasma, a cell with only about 500 genes. And we realized the only way to do it, because of the lack of existing tools in molecular biology, was to try and make a synthetic chromosome. So this project had its origins 15 years ago, so it's taken us quite a while to get there. So we've had the ability now to read the genetic code. So we take that digital information, the A's, G's, and T's, and as we read it in the proper order, we record that information in the computer as digital information. To build a synthetic chromosome, we start at the other end. We start with that digital information, the ones and zeros in the computer, DNA synthesizers that start with four bottles of chemicals, and now write chemically that genetic code again. We started in 2003 with a 5,000-letter bacteriophage, PhyX-174, that kills E. coli. And this is sort of repeating a famous experiment that was done in 1967 by Arthur Kornberg, where before they even knew the DNA sequence, they made a copy of the PhyX genome just using an enzyme and put that into bacteria, and the bacteria made the virus. So 33 years later, we made it chemically for the first time and repeated that experiment. But we wanted to make bacterial chromosomes that were 20 to 40 times larger. And so we had to develop the chemistry for making these large DNA molecules. And that's been a huge effort, a team of about 25 people now working pretty diligently since the 2002.
Well, what the core of this is, as I understand it, you've said that this is the first time you've built a self-replicating cell whose parent, in your phrase, is a computer. What does that mean?
So we started with this information in the computer. We wrote the genetic code, actually built this 1.08 million base pair chromosome. And for the first time, we were able to take that assembled chromosome out of the eukaryotic yeast, transplant it into a recipient bacteria, where it took over control of that cell and transformed that cell into an entirely new cell where the only DNA is the synthetic DNA. The only proteins are those made from that synthetic DNA. And it's a self-replicating cell. It's divided over a billion times already. So we're defining it as a cell controlled by a synthetic chromosome. Our own definition, this meets our definition of synthetic life, because everything in the cell comes from that chromosome, which came from four bottles of chemicals in the computer.
And what is the significance of this to a lay audience who doesn't follow the science but wants to know what this means?
Well, we consider this a baby step, the beginning, the proof of concept. So we've had this new field of synthetic biology where the notion is we can write new things in the genetic code to get cells to do things they didn't do before and that we'd like them to do. One example is we have a program with ExxonMobil trying to see if we can capture more carbon dioxide and convert it into hydrocarbons that can go into refineries to create gasoline and diesel fuel. After looking at tens of thousands of algae cells, there's not a single naturally occurring one that we found that has the properties to be able to robustly make billions of gallons of fuel on a consistent basis over time. So clearly the future of that field is to be able to make genetic mm-hmm. modifications. Now, DuPont tried that. It cost them $100 million in 10 years to make a handful of changes in E. coli to just go from sugar to a small chemical compound called propanediol that has three carbons. So if that's the way and the only way we could proceed, science would proceed very, very slowly. Now that we can write the genetic code, theoretically design things in the computer, now that we have the proof of concept, knowing that we can actually boot up that new software in a cell, it theoretically now opens up the avenue to make much more dramatic changes.
Let me ask the other two scientists here in the, at the table the same question. David Rejeski, what's your sense of the significance of what Craig and his team have been able to accomplish?
Well, I think the significance is actually quite tremendous. And I think one of the things that we don't recognize, because we tend to think in terms of ologies like nanotechnology or synthetic biology, is this is essentially about gaining control of matter at a nanoscale, at a biologically relevant scale. And so our ability to actually produce things with greater precision, mm-hmm. lower cost, faster speed is what made the last industrial revolution possible. And we had that control down to maybe a millionth of an inch. And now what we're doing here is extending it down to a nanoscale level. So my sense is, if you look out 100 years, this is the way we'll be making things for the next century. So it's incredibly important, and it can't happen unless we really have precision control over the manufacturing code.
That's an interesting analogy. So Sohi Rastegar of the previous industrial revolution, this concept of being able to control in a very finite and precise way the building blocks of an industrial revolution.
Exactly. I agree with that characterization. This makes possible whole new industries. The newness of this is the fact that they have been able to do the whole chromosome. People have done single gene, multiple genes before. For instance, I have to go back, like, synthetic biology is not really new in a sense, because if you look at Humulin, the insulin that diabetics use, it's a very common thing that people use, was done in 1980. Genentech was able to make E. coli produce insulin with the same amino sequences as the human insulin, and then this became a huge industry, and it's helping millions of people around the world. So the technology is there just by that small advance that was made then. Just imagine right now if you can manage the whole chromosome and synthesize it, and then program it to do other things that are useful.
If I can, perhaps I could say what it's not.
Yeah, very helpful, yes.
After reading a few thousand articles over the last few days, it's not life from scratch. We're actually building on top of the 3.5 billion years of evolution. A number of my colleagues are actually trying to recapitulate those early evolutionary steps by putting small numbers of proteins and lipid vesicles and trying to get life from scratch. We actually use an existing cell to boot up the chromosome. It starts reading the genetic code of this synthetic chromosome and starts making the new proteins, and that converts it into a new cell. So the numerous reports about it being life from scratch, we disagree with that. Also, it's not artificial life. It's real life. These cells are very much alive, self-replicating. Artificial life is what happens in the computer when that DNA software goes into cells and creates self-replicating cells. Microbiologists could not distinguish these cells from others without looking at their genetic code.
Part of what you're saying is that some of the claims that are being made, maybe the more exaggerated and popular accounts, you're not sharing. You think that some of these accounts have been outsized and overdrawn.
I've seen wide ranges in both directions of underestimations and overestimations.
So. There's talk that this is not just a scientific breakthrough, David Rejeski, but a philosophical change. Do you share that, and what do you think, in what sense there's a philosophical paradigm shift here?
Well, I think that one of the things that's interesting, we've done a lot of analysis just over the past 3 days on how it's been covered in the U.S. and also in Europe. And I think the thing that is a real trigger is that the emergence of a lot of religious and mythological imagery. So if you look at the cover of The Economist, it looks like something off the Sistine Chapel.
And popular imagery. NPR started their piece with references to Young Frankenstein. You know,
right. So what's appeared is, and there's always been this sort of, are we playing God imagery? But one of the things that's appeared, I think, is the sort of this mythological imagery. And one of the characters is Prometheus, which we hear a lot about, who stole fire from the gods and gave it to humans and ended up in eternal hell. The other one is obviously Frankenstein. We see that in a lot of headlines. But the subtitle of that book, when Mary Shelley put it out, was The Modern Prometheus. So again, it's sort of this Prometheus, I think, mythology. The other one is Pandora and Pandora's Box. So I think when you look at the headlines, one of the things that you find is the sort of framing of the headlines are very much about human fallibility, about ambition, about curiosity. They're very less about, I think, the actual discovery.
And so he, what's, from a philosophical point of view, what's the change here from a scientific point of view? Is there a different posture here, a different way of thinking that we're now about to embark on?
I think set aside the theological aspects of it, in terms of technological innovation, you know, the mission of NSF to advance discovery, innovation, and education. This will make possible for many new innovations and industries. So I would say it is a milestone, a serious milestone, that will make such discoveries more and more possible.
We'll talk more about those milestones and those possible implications when I return with my guest. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. Our subject this hour, the announcement just recently of a scientific breakthrough by the Craig Venter Institute on the whole question of scientific synthetic biology. Craig Venter is with me this morning, as well as David Rejeski from the Woodrow Wilson Center and Sohi Rastegar of the National Science Foundation. You can join us at 1-800-433-8850 or email, as always, drshow@wamu.org. And we have with us an extra guest. David Baltimore is on the phone. He's a professor of biology and president emeritus at Caltech. And Professor Baltimore, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
Now, our guests have been talking about some of the implications of this discovery. And you've been quoted in a number of places as saying, perhaps there's been a little hype and a little over-exaggeration. Give us your take on the meaning of what's been happening over the last week here.
Well, let me put it in context.
Good.
We started on this road of unraveling the basis of living systems back many, many years ago. I would date it really from the discovery of the structure of DNA in 1953. And since then, there has been a lineal development of very powerful technology to first learn how to read the DNA, then learn how to recreate it. And there have been many, many milestones along the way. And it has been a matter of wide understanding in the scientific community that, first of all, this was going on, and the second of all, we could see the trajectory of it.
Mm-hmm.
The trajectory was to get bigger and better at it, to first synthesize, you know, two units of DNA, and then four, and then eight, and then ultimately any number. And the human genome has 3 billion base pairs in it, so we've got to go a long way if we're going to ultimately create complex living systems. And what Craig has done here, Craig and his really remarkable team, is another milestone mm-hmm. in that lineal development.
Mm-hmm.
A predictable one, I think, one that took a lot of skill, particularly in the handling of these enormous pieces of DNA that they've made. I don't think anybody can touch them in their ability to move these things around and get them ultimately to drive a cell. But we've known for a long time that DNA drives cells and that all new proteins that are made in the cell are a matter of copying a code in DNA. And so I just see this as a piece of a long development. I do know, however, that the way publicity works, when something new has happened and is given a lot of prominence, even if it's predictable and really technological in its underpinnings, it will get public attention. And this has gotten public attention, and you've heard about the Frankensteins and the Prometheuses, all of which is a wonderful context to try to get across to people what has been going on in biology now for a very long time.
Of course, Craig Venter this morning described it as a baby step. He's tried to disassociate himself from some of the more exaggerated accounts, I think.
Yeah. I'm not arguing with Craig.
Let me ask you this, Professor Baltimore. Do you have ethical concerns here? President Obama, in reacting to this, said there are serious concerns. He's appointed a commission, or I guess it has an existing commission that's going to spend 6 months studying this. If you were consulting on this and being asked to talk to that commission, what are some of the questions you would raise?
I think there are ultimate questions about both interfering with the genetic material of human beings and of the creation of new living organisms. But I think most of those issues outside of human beings are practical issues and have been so since we organized the Asilomar meeting in 1975, which first looked at these questions. And what we have always been worried about is safety. Are we going to do something mm-hmm. which will be dangerous to somebody else? And that was what the Asilomar meeting was about, and that's what we think about all the time. I think nothing has happened in the ensuing time to change the fact that we are in a pretty good position, that we're not actually creating anything that we can't control. But we have to worry about that all the time.
Do you see any particular danger point, any particular area where the potential for this going off the track there is, for instance, a lot of the publicity is referred to the possibility of bioterrorism, of bad guys getting a hold of the ability to do what has been done in this laboratory and turn it for dastardly purposes. Is that part of on your list of concerns?
Absolutely, but I wouldn't say that this advance really has anything to do with heightening that concern,
mm-hmm.
because doing what Venter and his colleagues have done is really difficult and is not a route to making a biologically dangerous organism. But we can do that right now. We have a lot of dangerous organisms. It's a matter of turning them into weapons. And we've learned how to do that. So there's a real concern here that modern biology could generate new forms of bioterrorism. But the way that'll happen is not through total synthetic synthesis of a new organism, but rather by tinkering with existing organisms.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you really have to give evolution a huge amount of credit here. Evolution is what allows an organism to exist in this world. So giraffes are, you know, you go to Africa and you look at a giraffe and you say, what a strange thing that is.
Until you see the trees that they eat from, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's perfectly adapted to do just what it does. And if we created anything like a giraffe, we'd never get it right.
Let me ask Craig Venter your reactions to some of the things that David Baltimore said, and where, and pick up on this quote from the president, who said there are serious concerns here. Do you share that? I'm sure the president's commission will talk to you. What would you tell them? What are you thinking on this issue?
Well, I agree very much with what David said, and David, by the way, Ham Smith sends his regards to you. So. we do have a superb team with him and Clyde Hutchinson, an amazing team. So there has been concern ever since 2003 when we published the PhyX genome of concerns over national security. And I think it's one of the things that the Bush administration did positively for science. They reviewed this work, considered classifying it, and said it should actually be published in the open literature. Because this is important research to go forward. And I think discussing things with people in the administration and others, that people see this maybe at most a linear increase in the risk, but an exponential increase in the potential benefits. And David is right. This takes an incredibly skilled set of scientists right now to do this work. And I don't think there's going to be too many labs building a million base pair pieces of DNA in the immediate future. The technology is improving, and we have to be cognizant of it. But and the Sloan Foundation, which funded my institute along with MIT and others, including the Hastings Institute, that study revealed that the risk is much more in the line that David was talking about. There are so many other sources for people that want to do harm that they're not going to put a sophisticated team like this together to try and do that.
Let me ask the expert on public opinion here, David Rejeski. Since the public responds not just to the careful scientific calibrations of a David Baltimore or a Craig Venter, but to some of the more public and perhaps outsized interpretations of this, what you're the expert here, what does the public think about this? Are they supportive? Are they concerned? Do they share the calculation of benefit and risk that Craig was just talking about?
Well, we've done now, I think, about 5 years of polling, starting with nanotech. The last 2 years, we've moved to synthetic biology. And the interesting thing about the synthetic biology in both focus groups and national polls we've conducted is the more people learn about it, the less they like it. It tends to start with the term synthetic biology. And I think one of the problems that Dr. Venter hit on is people don't know what it is, but they also don't know what it isn't. And so when you hear that term, they associate it with all kinds of things from cloning to stem cells to genetically modified foods. So we haven't done a very good job there of sort of explaining people what it is and what it isn't. We do spend a lot of time in focus groups and polls trying to ground the science in applications and talk about what this could mean for biofuels, for medicine, for environmental cleanup. And still at the end of these polls, I would say that probably at least half or more of the people are worried about the research. 35% of the people in the last poll felt that the risks would outweigh the benefits. Over two-thirds are asking for government oversight of the research, and 90% think that a lot more should be done actually to inform the public about what's going on. The public is relatively ignorant. So the discussion is not going to be driven by the scientists. The discussion is going to be driven by popular culture, by video games and comics and movies. And in 2 weeks, there'll be a movie that comes out called Splice, and it's about genetic engineering. And if you watch the trailer on the movie, it goes something like this. Every moment in labs around the country, boundaries are being crossed, risks are being taken, and a line has just been crossed. Right? So what happens, I think, is that at one level you have the science discussion, And another level, mm-hmm. you have the cultural discussion, which is driven by all kinds of various narratives that scientists have very little control over.
I gather your polling is also, we've seen this now for years with genetic engineering, that Europe, far more critical, resistant to importing of meat and other things that have been produced, the feeds through genetic engineering. And so there's also a different countries and different cultures are responding in different
ways. Right. When we've looked at the press coverage, we've done this for the last 5 years, what we find is the U.S. tends to be much more bullish on technology. The press tends to focus on the benefits. They tend to focus less on the risks. The risks of synthetic biology here have been described largely around biosecurity issues. If we move to the European press, there's a much more balance, I think, between risk and benefit coverage. And the risks that are covered in the European press cover biosecurity, biosafety, issues of intellectual property, who owns this, and also issues of morality and ethics and business issues. So you have a much wider set of things that are covered in the press.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. What are the responsibilities, Sohi Restigar, of scientists to explain themselves? If part of the dissonance here is a clash almost between the outsized pop culture, the movies that exaggerate the problem, versus the very careful explanations that Craig Venter and David Baltimore have been giving, what's the responsibility here of the scientific community?
I think the scientific community, the more they do, the better it is. I think the scientific community is getting better and better in explaining what they do. At the National Science Foundation, we have Office of Legislative and Public Affairs that over the past few years has become even more aggressive in trying to explain the advances. But let me explain to you some of the benefits, the potential benefits, give you some analogies. So when we established synthetic biology engineering research centers 3 years ago, or about 4 years ago, their goal is to make biology easy to engineer. That doesn't mean that you understand all of biology. If you can understand just parts of biology and build some things with it, you can do revolutionary things. And I can give you the example of a truss assembly, which you have a piece of metal that you can put in arrangements in either a rectangular or triangular arrangements and put them together, and you can make this very light structure that is very, very sturdy. And with that, governed by very few principles, you can build industries on bridges, airplanes, and huge things. So if you can understand parts of biology on which you can modularly build systems that can benefit mankind, you can do huge things.
Right, but the engineering issue of building a bridge is not threatening in the same way.
I understand.
And I want to ask Craig Venter here, what your reaction to the public opinion and the concerns you might have that your work is being caricatured or misunderstood?
Well, we knew from our own history with the human genome, with science history, when Arthur Kornberg made this first polymerase copy of Phi-X, the headlines around the world was life was synthesized in a test tube. The President of the United States called it one of the most important steps. These things do capture people's imaginations and get them to think about these issues. I mean, it's even though we've been raising these issues now for 15 years, we've published a whole series of papers, we've had a lot of public discussion. We knew this would be the first time the majority of the public would hear mm-hmm. about this, because most people don't read about science. Unfortunately, he's absolutely correct that we get our science education through movies and entertainment in this country, not through an effective education system. So the response was a little bit more varied and greater scale than we anticipated. But scientists are sort of in a damned if you do, damned if you don't thing. So we did a press conference with the journal Science, who published our paper. If you don't do this, you get criticized. And if you do it, you get criticized. So I think it's important to have this open dialogue. We've heard from everybody from the President of the United States to the Vatican in the last few days. And so it stimulated some discussion and thinking.
And but what and when you say it's stimulated discussion and thinking, what have you learned since this came out? What have you learned either about how you have to portray this to the public? What have you learned about the public's concerns that you think are valid?
Well, I was pleasantly surprised that the vast majority of responses have been excitement and optimism about using this type of technology for the future. I would say less than 10% of the press and the blog writings that we've seen out there have been truly on the negative and fear side, and I think that's an encouraging, maybe it reflects the pro-American stance on technology. So I've been encouraged by that. The last thing we'd want to see in this field is new draconian regulations. David mentioned the Asilomar conference that started intelligent discussion in this whole field many decades ago.
That's Craig Venter from the Craig Venter Institute. David Rajeski is also with me, as well as Sohi Rastegar and David Baltimore, President Emeritus of Caltech. We'll be back with your calls, your questions, your emails. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By Ann and John Herman, supporting the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching, at breakthroughcollaborative.org. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
Many countries want the ban on commercial whale hunting more strictly enforced. Whaling nations want it eased. What a proposed compromise could mean for the future of the industry and the marine mammals. The Diane Rehm Show next hour. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, my guest this hour, talking about the stunning announcement last week that for the first time a self-replicating cell had been produced in the laboratory. And joining me, Craig Venter, whose institute produced this breakthrough, David Rajeski from the Director of Science and Technology Innovation Program and at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Sohi Rastegar is with the National Science Foundation. And on the phone, David Baltimore, who is Professor of Biology, President Emeritus at Caltech. And we've got a lot of folks who want to stay on, who want to join this. So let's start with Michael in Killdevil Hills, North Carolina. Michael, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning. What an honor to talk to such incredible thinkers. And, sirs, I've always found, as a wannabe scientist, that I've always had to break through the language of the scientists because I wasn't educated in the language. For instance, I love astronomy, but there are books written in a way that I can read them. I have double genetic iron overload disease called hemochromatosis. When I heard Mr. Craig speak, when he opened up the show, I saw a way, instantly saw a way where they could build a cell, a single cell, that would be, let's say, the parents are tested, and each parent, yes, has one gene, and they could give this disease to their child, like I have. And they inject, and all of a sudden, the one parent no longer has that gene to give to their child, and the child does not have that disease. That's how I see this technology being used. And then the sense of humor on the fear factor, which I no longer have with men of this caliber. I saw Noah with a whole computer farm inside the ark making all the animals. So,
Michael, we appreciate your call, and let's get Craig Venter's response.
Well, thank you for the call. There's been obviously a lot of suggested medical applications over the last 48 hours. I think the first things we'll see are not going to be gene therapy type of applications. I think the first thing the public might see is next year's flu vaccine. We're trying to make that synthetically so we can make it much more rapidly. I think these tools give us new ways to make pharmaceuticals that are beyond the reach of the existing chemist, and also perhaps to viruses that rapidly evolve. Those are at least some of the ideas. Human therapy is something that it's not part of my imagination yet in terms of changing people's genes. I think that's the first thing people thought of after the human genome. I think we're a very long way away from that.
Since the oil spill is very much on people's minds this morning, Scott from Jackson, is it Mississippi or Michigan, Scott?
Yes. I guess two things I want to talk about, mass-producing oil-consuming bacteria and also cross-pollination as genetic pollution. Okay, this is just an idea I had, and I actually called this into the BP 800 number that they have through the EPA. But basically, I've heard that naturally occurring in the ocean, there are bacteria that consume crude oil. Okay, so it seems to me, and this wouldn't be necessarily genetic engineering, simply isolating an existing bacteria and mass producing it. So, for example, you might be able to mass produce these oil-consuming bacteria and then, say, spray them on a fragile wetland that you can't easily hose down like a beach or something like that. And these oil-consuming bacteria would convert the crude oil into something less harmful. And I just wanted to get that idea on the table. But I guess since we're talking about Frankenstein scenarios, probably the most alarming thing that I ever saw concerning genetic engineering was I was a TV interview with a guy who was engineering corn to produce insulin for diabetics, which is, again, a worthy ideal. However, the interviewer was sort of astute enough to ask the guy, he says, well, what have you done to isolate, you know, this insulin-producing corn from other corn plants? And he says, oh, well, gee, the nearest other corn field is like 5 miles away. And when I heard that, I said, well, so what? You know, this guy needs a course in basic botany. You know, talk about the birds and the bees.
We're getting a little off the topic here, Scott. Craig, thanks for your call. And Craig, try to answer the first question. It's on a lot of people's minds. And let's also be out front. You are in partnership with Exxon, as you mentioned.
Exxon and BP are both funding research to, in fact, find alternatives. And I think that's going to be far more important to wean our dependency off of oil. We can't see carbon dioxide, but we can definitely see this oil floating on the water and on the beaches as a reminder that we really need to get new alternatives. And I think the most promising aspect of this technology is to potentially get us to where we could produce billions of gallons of fuel from carbon dioxide instead of taking the carbon out of the ground.
Now, let me read an email from Sandy in Cincinnati, and we've got a number of emails on this subject. I worry, Sandy writes, that the profiteers will patent the fruits of this science, thus preventing wide benefit to mankind, such as affordable vaccines and medical treatments. The business of science makes the benefits too expensive. This has already occurred with some DNA discoveries. David Baltimore, what's your take on this subject raised by Sandy?
Well, I think it's a serious issue that we're tying up a lot of technology in individual patents that are voted to the work of individual companies.
But the other side of it is that this is a way to energize corporate America to utilize these technologies in the service of helping to cure disease, helping to solve energy problems, etc. So it cuts both ways. If you didn't have patents, if you didn't have private ownership of technology, you simply wouldn't have the kinds of revolutions that we've seen in medical treatments that have come about, or for that matter, in plant genetic engineering, which I happen to think has been a very important development that offers a lot to people. But things are done by corporations. The corporation is entitled to a profit from it, and that bothers people. They would like to see all this technology being developed in a non-profit framework,
right.
Government framework, for instance.
Well, now
the history is it just doesn't happen that way.
Well, that's an interesting point. And Craig, in your institute, you're a nonprofit institute, but you are in partnership with profit-making corporations that have invested heavily in your work. You mentioned Exxon and BP in the area of vaccines and medical technologies. You're partners with Novartis, the big pharmaceutical company. Explain why you've decided to go this route rather than government funding, and how do you handle the question raised by Sandy of preserving the public benefit of this work?
Well, in fact, Ham Smith and I formed the biotech company Synthetic Genomics as a means for funding this research at our not-for-profit institute. So there wasn't adequate government funding. We had a little bit early on, but as we scaled up in this project, there was little interest in the government and funding it. They thought it was too far out and not likely to work. Mm-hmm. So if it wasn't for private industry, we wouldn't have gotten to this breakthrough. But over the years, I've developed maybe a philosophy similar to what David was saying. We can publish all the papers in the scientific literature we want on creating new fuels, new techniques. If there's not a new, truly cost-effective solution out there, it's not going to have any impact. We need things that really work. They have to work commercially, or we won't get weaned off of oil, for example.
And David, you've been studying the public opinion on this. What are you learning about this question of public benefit and private profit?
Well, I think that's always an issue that's been raised by the public is who benefits and who loses. I think the interesting thing about synthetic biology is because it's a fairly porous field and you've had people enter it from the fields of engineering and computer sciences, they've brought with them a kind of interest in open source that we saw a lot of in computer programming. So that there's, I think, a lot of tension in the synthetic biology field about this control of IP versus open source models. So people are beginning to build sort of registries of standard parts, almost Lego things that could be shared, and you can use those to sort of build more complex devices.
Well, this is partly the BioBricks phenomenon, which is very much a part of this. Can you explain what that means?
Well, again, a lot of the engineers are sort of approaching this, that we could create a kind of standard package of almost an erector set of biological parts from which people can begin to create new organisms and new biological capabilities. That's a very interesting tension. I don't think it's going to be resolved immediately, but I think it's something that you're seeing in synthetic biology that hasn't been seen before in some of the other areas that we've studied.
Let me turn to Bob in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Bob.
Good morning. Yes, I can't imagine a more seductive challenge for a molecular biologist than the challenge to create a new form of life, which seems to be essentially what you've done. But I'm concerned that I haven't heard anything about safety procedures that you've taken to be sure that these new forms of life don't escape into the environment where they could possibly reproduce themselves uncontrollably. I mean, you could be producing virulent pathogens, either against humanity or against the other forms of life in the environment. I mean, I'm not trying to create a scare using scare tactics. But clearly, if these are new forms of life, they haven't evolved with the rest of the environment, so there are no natural enemies, as it were. What steps are you taking to be sure that you're not that something of this type won't happen?
Thank you very much. It's a call that a lot of our callers have raised that subject in one form or another. Craig?
This goes back to what David mentioned with the Selimar. There's been now several decades of probably 10 million experiments done with putting genes from different species into E. coli without a single incident that I'm aware of where that escaped because there was a chemical dependency in the laboratory. And I think this is an important concept that we and others are trying to build into synthetic biology. We can actually build in suicide genes, even some of the exciting advances in unnatural amino acids to create an absolute dependency for these. And that's also why we started watermarking our DNA so we can identify it as synthetic and distinguish it from any other species and distinguish it as the lab of its origin. So I think there's a lot of different methods for doing this. The first organism, it's a new strain of Mycoplasma mycoides with very few differences. This only grows in extremely rich media in the lab, and we eliminated 14 genes that, according to the scientific literature, make it non-infective in goats. So these are good comments and a key direction that this field has to move in.
I'm Steve Roberts. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. David Baltimore, you raised the question of safety, and our caller raised a question that a lot of our callers and emailers have raised. What's your reaction to that concern about the dangers here?
Well, the reason I mentioned giraffes a while ago is because organisms have to adapt to be able to grow in wild circumstances. It's not something that happens automatically. And putting a new gene into an existing organism, for instance, is almost certainly going to make it less fit rather than more fit. And that's exactly the message from all of these years of research that Craig was talking about, that the more we do to organisms to make them synthetic, the more they serve our purposes, but the less they are able to function in a wild, natural environment. And I think that's our biggest protection. It has always been our biggest protection. If you go back to the Asilomar meeting, the critics of the Asilomar meeting were saying just that. We don't really have to worry about this stuff because everything we do makes things less fit rather than more fit. And in a sense, they've been vindicated.
Let me read you an email, and this is one of many we've gotten on this subject in one form or another. Jerry McNamara writes, "So far, your panelists have artfully dodged philosophical and moral discussions. No wonder that's where the press is focused. Here's my question, and behind it, I am sure you sense my concern about the morals and ethics of this. If we know that chromosomes trigger certain diseases in humans, wouldn't it be possible to create cells that would trigger a devastating disease such as Alzheimer's and use it as a slow-growth weapon in a country? And if that is true, what could be done to stop it?" How do you answer people like Jerry, Craig?
Well, unfortunately, it's difficult to answer them because it's sort of built on science fiction and not a lot of knowledge. There's a huge difference, as David said, between our 6 billion letters of the human genome and making a million-letter genetic code bacteria. We're not advocating making humans, and people have been worried about human-specific pathogens and even race-specific pathogens. It's part of the lexicon that's out there on the internet, but there's no scientific validity for it whatsoever. If you were looking under a microscope where you could see the human chromosomes, the genome that we just synthesized would be so small you would not see that on the same scale. So it's a huge leap going from small bacteria to making animals and humans.
We only have another 2 minutes, and I want to give each of you a quick chance to say, where is this going? What's the next breakthrough? Sohi?
I think the next breakthrough is that we will have purely biologically based industries coming in. We'll see a breakthrough in biofuels. We'll see a breakthrough in rapid production of pharmaceuticals. Some of them are underway. Probably those are the two that will be at the frontier.
David Baltimore, quickly.
First of all, let me argue with your question. I don't think you can ever predict a breakthrough.
Okay, fair enough.
It's not a breakthrough. So given that, where are we going to see the next use of genetic technologies? My great hope is that we're going to be able to see the fruits of gene therapy develop so that, in particular, we can alter the immune systems to allow the immune system to fight cancer for us.
Very interesting. David Rzeski, quickly.
I think the most interesting thing to watch right now and hard to predict will be social reaction. I think you'll see an enormous mobilization of environmental and activist groups. This will get the attention of governance and policymakers, and so you're going to see a lot of people beginning to think about regulation. And it's going to, I think, stimulate a much broader and needed debate within the public about where's the science going.
Craig, final word.
I think it's changed at least my view of the understanding of life, how dynamic it is, how you just put in new software and the cell turns into what that software tells it to do. I think as we try to create this new perhaps economic change with this technology, this will be part of the solution.
That's Craig Venter from the Venter Institute, which is the one that created this breakthrough. David Drzejewski has been with me from Woodrow Wilson Center. Sohi Rostegar from the National Science Foundation. David Baltimore, President Emeritus of Caltech. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in today for Diane. Thanks so much for spending the hour with us.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner.